Can we live without oil? Amory Lovins thinks so, and he says we can break the habit by 2050. Lovins lays out his blueprint for that clean energy future in his new book, Reinventing Fire. He joins us this hour to talk about solar-powered buildings that make more energy than they use, cars that get hundreds of miles per gallon on biofuel. Plus, this weekend, another satellite is scheduled to crash down to Earth, just a month after the last one. Coming up, a look at space junk. Can we control when and where it falls? And this month's science fiction, the history of that icon of the chemistry lab, the Bunsen burner. All coming up. Stay with us. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Sometime Saturday night, a defunct German X-ray satellite named ROSAT is going to come screaming through the atmosphere on its way to impact on the Earth's surface. The chances of the piece of this thing, or any piece, will it'll hit somebody? Well, somewhere on the surface of the Earth, one in 2,000. The chance it'll hit you in particular are, of course, much lower, so you can crawl out from underneath that table. Deja vu, just last month, a NASA satellite did the same crashing act, diving into the Pacific. We put all the stuff into orbit, you know, that old saying about what goes up has to come down eventually, right? Or can we do something about it? What do you think? Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And let me introduce my guest. We'll be talking more about this whole event and what we can do and how much junk is there up there. Mark Matney is an orbital debris scientist. Get that kind of job at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Matney.
Good to be here.
You're welcome. Phil Plait is an astronomer and author of Bad Astronomy blog for Discovery Magazine. He's based in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Plait.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Hey there. Phil, tell us about this German satellite. What did it do? Why was it still working? Why is it coming down?
Well, ROSAT is short for the Röntgen satellite. Röntgen, with an umlaut over the O, was a German scientist who discovered X-rays, and the satellite was named after him because it observed the sky in X-rays, and it was an astronomical satellite that observed exploding stars and galaxies and all kinds of high-energy, violent events like that. It was launched by NASA in 1990, served for many years, did great work for the astronomical community. There was a glitch many years ago that shut it down. It's been in orbit ever since, and now its number is up.
And do we know when exactly it's coming down?
Well, we don't know exactly because it's very difficult to know exactly when a satellite's going to come down. The Earth's atmosphere is hard to model. It's very thin up there, 100 miles or more up, but it exists. And sometimes it's a little bit denser, sometimes not. And the satellite might be tumbling, and so it makes it very difficult to know exactly when it's come down. It's going to come down, excuse me. But what you said is pretty good. It should be coming down sometime this weekend. As time goes on, the predictions will get more accurate.
Mark Matney, just how much junk is up there?
Well, it turns out that the United States Space Surveillance Network, which is mostly our military assets, spend all of their time looking at space, and they track something. They have a catalog of about 16,000 objects in Earth orbit right now. And those are objects larger than about a softball in size.
Mm-hmm. And do we expect all of them to someday come down?
Most of them. The ones that are out of geosynchronous orbit probably will not anytime soon, but all of the ones that are in the first several thousand miles eventually for several thousand miles from the surface of the Earth will eventually come down, but it's a very strong function of how high they are. The higher they are, the less altitude, less atmosphere they encounter, and the slower they'll come down.
So somebody is keeping track of every single one of these little pieces.
Well, down to a certain size. The radars can only see down to a certain size, and it's about 10 centimeters, about 4 inches, and that's the catalog. We also keep track of those in case we need to move the space station out of the way, which it periodically does.
And could pieces be coming down all the time, the tiny pieces that we just don't know about?
Yeah, mm-hmm. About once a day, something in orbit that we catalog and track reenters the Earth's atmosphere.
Once a day?
Once a day. But most of them are very tiny, and they burn up upon reentry. About once a week, an intact object comes in, a rocket body or a satellite. So that happens pretty often. I actually did a quick set of numbers before I talked to you today, and there have been something like 4,000 objects, actually more than 4,000 objects, larger than 1 ton, that have reentered the Earth's atmosphere since the beginning of the space age.
We haven't heard about 4,000.
Yeah, oh. Most of them you don't hear anything about.
Mark, what do you think about that? Phil, what do you think about that?
Those numbers sound about right. It's funny to hear it that way because you start to think, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. But in fact, what this is telling you that is that it's very rare for us to even know about these things coming down. And people tend to panic when they hear that a satellite is coming in, something like ROSAT or the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, which came in last month. But in fact, these aren't that big of a danger. It's certainly something to be aware of, but it's not something to panic over.
Are there big pieces of this ROSAT going to survive the trip through the atmosphere?
Actually, yes. ROSAT waves.
Anyway, you just told me not to be afraid.
Well, the point here is that the Earth is really big, and these pieces are really small, and you occupy an extremely small part of the surface area of the planet. So even with 4,000 of these things coming in over the past 50 years, we've only had instances, I think, one person who had a little tiny piece of metal bounce off her shoulder.
A piece of insulation. It didn't even hurt her.
Yeah, right. And I've seen a rocket booster reenter. I thought it was just a very bright meteor, but then the next day I found out it was a booster. So these things happen without us knowing about it. And with ROSAT, we do know about it, and some things we do know in advance, and ROSAT was a famous satellite. Weighs about 2.5 tons, which makes it about a third of the size of the satellite that came in last month. But ROSAT is going to fall apart a little bit more, so there should be 30 pieces or so that will probably hit the ground intact. They have to understand how the spacecraft is put together and make models of what can survive reentry, but the number they come up with is approximately 30. Most of these are only going to weigh a couple of pounds. However, the mirror assembly of ROSAT, the thing that actually focused, if you want to say that, the X-rays, the part that saw the X-rays, that will probably come down intact, and that weighs a lot. It's actually well over a ton, and it's going to come in intact and hit the ground. Now, the good news for that is that that's one piece falling over an entire planet, and the Earth is 70% water, and what's land is relatively uninhabited. So, again, like you said at the beginning, the odds of anybody getting hit by any of these pieces is a couple of thousand to one against.
Mark, is there any way to know if, you know, as it gets closer to actually getting close to the Earth, to put out a warning sign if it's going to get over some piece of land to tell people to watch out?
Well, even in the final hours of any reentry, there's still a great deal of uncertainty. And basically, we can narrow it down to the last few revolutions, but those revolutions cover a significant chunk of the Earth's surface. So, in a sense, just to give an example, in the UR's case, about a day before, we were pretty confident it wasn't going to fall over North America, but then something changed on the spacecraft and changed its drag slightly, and as a result, the final orbits, some of them did pass over North America. Fortunately, it landed in the ocean, but that just shows you how difficult it is to predict the final stages of these reentries.
Would it be possible to actually shoot the thing down if you could see it was going to go to a bad place?
Well, in principle, you could. If you recall, we did that with USA-193, but the concern there was it had a tank full of toxic hydrazine, quite a bit of it, actually, and there was a great concern that would fall in a populated area and create a very large cloud of toxic gas. Because the odds are so small on these reentries and the effort and expense to actually intercept something is pretty extreme, these standard reentries really don't warrant that kind of mitigation.
Well, you know, shouldn't there be a policy that if you put something up in space, you should clean up after yourself?
Well, actually, we've been moving in that direction. Both of these spacecraft, URs and ROSAT, were launched in about 1990. But since about 1995, our knowledge of reentries has gotten a lot better, and internationally, we've been moving, a number of different spacefaring countries have been moving in directions to try and design their spacecraft that if it has a risk on the ground, we've developed the computational capabilities to compute those risks. If the risk exceeds a certain value, the value we use in the United States is 1 in 10,000, that you really ought to think about changing the design of your spacecraft, make it out of metals that won't survive reentry, or perhaps put an engine on it or extra fuel so you can do a targeted reentry and drop it out over the Pacific Ocean where it won't hurt anyone. We did that with the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. We reentered it over the Pacific Ocean. And, yes.
So designing them more to control reentry a bit.
Well, yes, to try and target where you're going to put it in. The other thing is something we call design for demise, and that's what I mentioned. You talk to the engineers from the very beginning, and you say, look, you need to design your spacecraft not out of these materials like titanium or steel that are likely to survive reentry, but see if you can use some other metals that will disintegrate upon reentry.
Mm-hmm. Phil, do the sun cycles, you know, we know the sun has periodic cycles. Does that affect where these things might fall?
Bizarrely, it does. When the sun is active and has a lot of sunspots, there are a lot of solar flares and coronal mass ejections, which blast out subatomic particles. The Earth's atmosphere puffs up in reaction to these when they hit us. And it's a tiny effect, but these satellites are orbiting up there where even a tiny effect over a long period of time can affect them. As I understand it, ROSAT was originally thought to burn up last year, but the Earth's atmosphere has been relatively calm because the sun has been quiet. We had a very long, quiet period from the sun, much longer than usual. It's just now starting to ramp up. 2013, 2014 is when we're going to start seeing a lot of solar activity again, although there's been a little bit.
So it's
odd to think that satellites might come in because of the sunspot cycle, but there you go.
So if you need this weekend to have a party, a ROSAT party, everybody comes as a satellite, some Sputnik or something, Telstar.
A friend of mine is having a ROSAT reentry party, actually.
I knew someone was having it. Would have what would a party like to be like? Do people do come dressed as satellite debris? Could you be a canister, a booster rocket?
Well, I dressed as Hubble for a Halloween party many years ago, so it's not that hard. But the problem is when do you throw the party? You may not know until a day in advance, as Mark said, and you got to realize these satellites are moving very rapidly. Orbital speed is about 5 miles per second. So if you're off in your calculations by a minute, that's 300 miles. So we don't know where it's going to come down because of that. And in fact, these estimates of when it's going to come down are still plus or minus, you know, a day at the moment, although they'll get much better over the next 24 hours or so.
Well, you gave me a good idea. This being Halloween coming out, if you dressed as a piece of the ROSAT satellite, no one could say you weren't, right? Depending on their analysis of your metallurgy.
Well, if you want to walk around with a 1,600-pound mirror wrapped around, yeah, I guess that's your 3,000 pounds, I suppose.
All right. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and we'll be watching that satellite with you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mark Matney is an orbital debris scientist at NASA at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and Phil Plate is an astronomer and author of a Bad Astronomy blog for Discover Magazine, based in Boulder. So you now have an excuse to what to do, how to dress up for Halloween with the ROSAT if you'd like to. We're going to take a break and come back and change directions. We're going to talk about the future, a future without oil. Running on clean energy, biofuels. Can we do it by 2050? My next guest thinks so. Amory Lovins will join us after this break. Stay with us. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcasts, websites, social media, phone apps. So please give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine you no longer have monthly utility bills. All that money you used to spend on gas and electricity, still in the bank. Instead, you get a check every month for making electricity, using your solar shingles on your roof and pumping that surplus electricity back into the grid. Or imagine pulling into a gas station, but it no longer sells gasoline. Instead, you can top off your car with electricity, hydrogen, biofuels, whatever. To those of you who already have solar panels on your roofs or an electric car in the garage, this may not sound so far-fetched. For the rest of us, this is the future. Let's talk about the year 2050, as imagined by my next guest. He says we can quit using oil and coal to power our country by 2050, and not just for the health of the environment, but for national security, creating jobs, and saving money, motivations that he says transcend politics. But is this really possible? Is it reasonable to expect politicians, automakers, and big oil and coal to innovate and disrupt, quote, business as usual? How is all this stuff going to get done and save or create jobs? Those answers are all in my next guest book, Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Amory Lovins is author of this book. He's co-founder, chairman, and chief scientist at Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. Good to be back.
You have a bold plan here, and you always think boldly, Amory. If it's worth thinking,
well, we try, and this is a pretty ambitious effort because 3/4 of our staff have been at it for about a year and a half.
Well, to sketch out the plan for us.
Yeah. Well, first, what we found is you can run a very prosperous U.S. economy 2.6 times today in 2050 with no oil, no coal, also no nuclear energy, and a third less natural gas. It's $5 trillion cheaper in net present value than business as usual. The transition requires no new inventions, no acts of Congress, and it's led by business for profit. And to get there, we took seriously some advice attributed to General Eisenhower that if a problem cannot be solved, enlarge it until the bigger system boundary includes more options, synergies, degrees of freedom, whose absence made it insoluble when you had too small a view of the problem. So we integrated all four sectors that use energy and in which we've worked in equal depth, namely transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity, and indeed did find that, for example, it's much easier to solve the automobile and electricity problems together than separately. We also integrated four kinds of innovation, not just in technology and policy, but also in design, the way technologies are combined, and in new business models and competitive strategies. And together, those give much more than the sum of the parts, especially in creating very disruptive business opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So there are job creations here, because you hear always the opponents of new energy, alternative energy, saying that they're going to lose jobs, or if we build green products, those jobs are going overseas. There was a talk this week about some American solar panel makers complaining to the U.S. government that it was unfair trade practices, the Chinese dumping all these solar panels here below cost, and that there should be tariffs on them. How do you get past those arguments?
Well, you could just look at what's happening in much of the rest of the world. In Germany, for example, there's fuller employment now than there was before the Great Recession, and that is due in substantial part to the conservative chancellor Angela Merkel's, I think, smart bet that it's a better deal to invest in your own engineers, installers, and manufacturers than to keep, say, buying Russian gas, because then you get the jobs. And similarly, the more we innovate in solar, wind power, and the other world market winners, the more we will get the manufacturing jobs, not just the installation jobs, which, of course, cannot be offshored because your roof isn't going anywhere.
Are you saying in your book, and because it's subtitled Bold Business Solutions, Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, that it's not difficult to convince businesses that this is a moneymaker for them?
Well, that is our the initial reaction that we're getting. The book only launches actually on October 27th, next Thursday, and in fact we'll be officially releasing it at a free public event that day hosted by the National Geographic. So if you go to rmi.org/natgeo, you can find out more and register. But I've been giving a sneak preview, as I am with you today, to some business audiences recently, and they're very interested, particularly when they learn there's $5 trillion net on the table, not counting any externalities, positive or negative. We assume those are all worth zero, which is a conservatively low estimate. And, of course, if we counted those hidden costs, the business case would get stronger. But businesses are interested in enhanced revenues, avoided risks, and gains in competitive advantage. And our approach to all four sectors is very rich in those things.
One of the scenarios that people envision is that public transportation will be modernized, streamlined. Cars will run in tandem on highways, maybe buses and trains too. But that also means that you may be putting some people out of jobs, are you not, who might be driving those buses or riding or those trains.
There would actually be more buses and trains. Our scenario does not depend heavily on transit, although it does count IT-enabled ways to enhance transit, car sharing, ride sharing, and also ways to make traffic free-flowing, ways to charge for road infrastructure by the mile instead of the gallon, ways to use lucrative real estate models, smart growth, new urbanism, and so on, so people are already more where they want to be. And by doing those things, you can actually reduce driving by a surprising 46% to 84% and get the same or better access. But at the root of our transport suggestions is radical efficiency in vehicles, and not just the usual tripled efficiency cars and trucks that are coming at us, trucks and planes rather, but also a revolution in how we design and build and run automobiles. Two-thirds of the energy it takes to move an auto is caused by its weight, and every unit of energy you can save at the wheels by taking obesity out of the car, less weight, less drag, saves an additional 6 units that you don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So you actually save 7 units of fuel at the tank for each unit of energy reduction in what it takes to move the vehicle. So we focus on some new manufacturing technologies now offered by 8 companies for making cars out of ultra-light but ultra-safe materials. And it turns out when you make carbon fiber cars properly and design them in a more integrative way, it costs the same as making a regular car. That is, the ultra-lighting is free because the propulsion system gets 2 or 3 times smaller and the manufacturing is so greatly simplified that it needs only a fifth as much capital.
But you're talking about the future where cars may be cheaper. I mean, getting from here to there, the cars are still going to be more expensive at this point, will they not?
Well, what the ultralighting does right away is make electrification much more affordable. And then you're harnessing 3 very steep learning curves, one in the carbon fiber, one in the manufacturing, another in the propulsion system itself, cheaper batteries and fuel cells and so on. But first of all, you use fewer batteries and fuel cells. And indeed, BMW has confirmed that in its carbon fiber electrified car entering mass production in 2013, one of 3 cars in the next year or two entering mass production that are carbon fiber electrified, they say the carbon fiber is paid for by needing fewer batteries. Now, it is true, though, that as you suggest, the electric cars are initially more expensive, even though they have a good value proposition, say, to fleet buyers. And to cope with that, we suggest a very effective, innovative policy called a feebate. That means rebates for efficient new autos paid for by fees on inefficient ones. And we'd like to do it not just in a revenue-neutral way, but separately for each size class, so that you're rewarded for buying a more efficient car of the type and size that you want, but not a smaller one than you want.
So let me see how that would work. So somebody who drives a gas guzzler would pay some sort of tax, and you would get it to buy a more efficient car.
Well, this only applies to new car purchases, not to what you're driving now. So when you go to the dealer to buy a vehicle of your choice, there are more and less efficient offerings, but the price spread between them is widened according to how efficient or inefficient each one is compared to a norm for that size, and it's trued up every year to keep it revenue neutral. So the effect is that you will pay attention not just to the first year or two of fuel savings when you're making your purchasing decision, but to the first 15 years, the full life of the vehicle. And therefore, you'll make a choice that's more efficient for society. There are actually five programs like this in European countries now, and the biggest one, just in its first 2 years, tripled the speed of improving auto efficiency. But that's even before the big effect of it kicks in, and that is that automakers will make very different offerings, so your choice as a customer will expand. You'll have a lot more efficient things to choose from.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Andre in Jenison, Michigan. Hi, Andre.
Hello.
Hi there.
My question is, in the future, will there be triple-decker buses with, like, more than four wheels and, like, hexagonal frames designs?
I have no idea. Triple-decker is, I guess, can that fit underneath bridges and stuff would be a good question. And is it stable? But certainly the double-deckers in London work just fine, and you see them in some American cities for tourism.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about alternative energy generation, because I was, as I follow this around the country, you see that wind energy, solar energy seems to be a local thing. You see stories of local towns, or is now talk about putting wind generators off of Rhode Island, things like that. I was reading today a story in the New York Times this week about Texas. This was amazing. Texas is spending almost $7 billion to build power lines that will carry wind-generated electricity to other parts of the state because they're the number one wind-generating state.
Yeah,
none of this
they were 8% wind-powered last year.
You don't get much of this. Doesn't get much of attention. Much attention anywhere else. A lot of these little projects, and you get the idea no one's doing anything until you just dig down.
Well, until you start looking around the world and you realize it's not just certain states in the U.S. that are doing very well with this. Texas, one of the leaders, of course, because they want to make money. But, for example, in Portugal, in the last 5 years, they took their renewable electricity from 17% to 45%, while the U.S. went from 9% to 10%. The last 3 years, the U.S. has actually declined from number one to number two to number three in clean energy installations. So in this now $200 billion a year global market, growing tens of percent a year, we're tending to miss out, and these technologies we invented are increasingly made overseas, China being the leader in five of them and intending to be in all. So we risk, as Tom Friedman says, buying all this stuff we invented from China. The good news is it'll be cheaper than our tennis shoes, but it would be better to make it here. And I'm therefore dismayed that last year congressional dithering the fifth time around cut U.S. wind power installations in half, while Chinese wind installations, nearly half the total in the world, blew past their 2020 target, and they doubled their wind installations for about the fifth year running. These wounds are self-inflicted, but one of the interesting things we found in looking at different electricity systems is that as we rebuild our dirty, insecure, obsolete in many ways electricity system, which we have to do anyway over the next 40 years, it's going to cost about $6 trillion net present value no matter what we build.
Let me just interrupt and remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR.
So we're going to have to rebuild the electricity system anyway, and we are rebuilding it day by day. But if we look at what we could rebuild, we could do business as usual. We could do a new nuclear and so-called clean coal scenario. We could do centralized renewables, distributed renewables. And surprisingly, these four scenarios differ only immaterially in cost, but they differ profoundly in risk. And that is what is often driving investors away from the big thermal plants whose orders are withering and into the renewables, which, excluding big hydro, got worldwide $151 billion of private capital last year, and they added 60 billion watts. And in fact, that's the amount of solar power the world will be able to make every year by the end of December this year.
Mm-hmm. What will those stories about like Solyndra do to the alternative energy efforts? People point to that saying, see, we told you.
Well, it's a political distraction. But, of course, what Congress told the Department of Energy to do was to take risks that the private sector would not take by itself. In this case, the private sector did invest over twice as much as the taxpayers did, and the taxpayers will probably get much or most of their money back. But the reason that this company failed, it's maybe 2% of DOE's portfolio, is a success. The company did everything it was supposed to. Meanwhile, China dropped the price even faster. And because of that rapidly declining solar price, which was the objective of the whole exercise, the more commodity Chinese solar panels were able to undercut the price of the more advanced American technology before they could get to scale. Well, we risk having that happen to us more and more if we don't have a level playing field and fair competition and access to the grid. But it's interesting that last year those commodity solar panels got cheap enough that in recent months, California's private utilities have bought over 4 billion watts of the stuff because it beats power from a new gas plant. And in a dozen states now, four companies will be happy to put solar panels on your roof with no money down and beat your utility bill.
All right. We'll come back and talk lots more with Amory Levins, author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I, or join our Facebook discussion, Facebook.com/SciFry, or our website at ScienceFriday.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at ScienceFriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Amory Levins, author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones. Kelly in San Francisco. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Ira. This is Zara Kelly. I'm a big fan of your show. We just recently bought San Francisco fix-up a house, and last year my husband and I built it, and it's completely solar power. There is no gas line going in. We're getting actually our money back from PG&E, who is our local electrical company, probably between $300 to $400. And we got so excited, we also went out and bought our first electrical car. And we're still getting money back from PG&E. So it's just sweet. And I want to say that it's doable. It's just sad to hear all the bad news, but I do think we need some government support. That's how we got some nice government support on that regard for building our house efficient. We use whatever we could find in the market, making the house very efficient, getting the heating just right, so we could actually powered by just solar. And
wow.
I'm just excited.
Are you off the grid, Kelly, or are you still on the grid?
No, we're still on the grid. So at nighttime when there is no solar energy, we use PG&E services. Right. But we produce so much during the day, especially the high peak, that actually we get money back still at the end of the month, each month. So we do every month.
We do exactly the same thing, Kelly. We use, in our house, solar in the daytime, wind power that we buy from our co-op at night, and we're a net exporter of electricity. And also our house is what's called islandable, which means it works with or without the grid. So when we have power failures up in the Rocky Mountains, we don't even know. We just keep going.
Well, thanks for calling, Kelly. Good luck to you.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What is the government's role here, Amory?
Well, there are some temporary subsidies, which are generally political pawns to renewables. What's seldom mentioned is that there are generally bigger permanent subsidies to fossil fuel and nuclear energy. And I would like actually to get rid of all of them, those subsidies, and let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly at honest prices, regardless of their type, technology, size, location, or ownership. That's pretty much the opposite of the energy policy we have. There's a very important government role in allowing free competition and interconnection to the grid. So there's more of a level playing field. And that is done mostly by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But utilities tend to be regulated at a state level, and there it's really important in the 34 states that haven't done this reform yet to reward our utilities for cutting our bills, not for selling us more energy, which rewards the opposite of what we want.
Let me just say this. Yeah. You think that if we let them all float freely, all the different energies, coal, oil, nuclear, solar, wind, whatever, that the alternative energies could compete effectively with the other ones?
Yes, and in fact, in the long run, as the higher volumes manufactured cut the cost further through learning curves, we found that unsubsidized renewables can ultimately compete even with the non-renewable sources that would continue to get, we assume, all of the subsidies they get now. Also, of course, when you buy renewables or efficiency, you're getting other kinds of risk reduction that save money. For example, there's less financial risk in building small, fast, granular projects than big, slow, lumpy ones. Mm. And when you buy solar or wind power to replace gas power, you're avoiding the volatility of the gas price, which is worth over $2 on the gas price. So you're actually getting more value than you expected by getting a free gas price hedge. Mm-hmm. So we also look a bit at what happened if we use this kind of financial economics that takes account of risk, because that's another way of finding the extra value in the renewables. But the real surprising thing we found is that all of the innovative policies needed in each sector to realize this transition from oil and coal to efficiency renewables can be done administratively or at a state level. So policies are needed to unlock or speed the transition, but they don't require an act of Congress. So we're end-running Washington gridlock, and we're doing that by using the most effective institutions we have, free enterprise in its coevolution with civil society and accelerated by military innovation, to end run the ineffective institutions, notably Congress.
So what is the block in Congress against renewables? And when did green become so political? I mean, we have states like Texas, producing all this. You can't get a more conservative state. At least you listen to the governor is running for president. Yet they have incredible renewable sources of wind there. We had the Secretary of the Navy come on here to talk about how the Navy is trying to become more greener and trying to become more energy conservative to save the lives of Marines and other soldiers in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. How does this – there's a disconnect here, it seems to me.
Well, there is actually a lot of bipartisan support in Congress and at a state level. Many of the states with renewable portfolio standards encouraging renewables are indeed red states. I think what you're referring to is probably that some parts of the political establishment on both sides tend to view, say, solar tax credits, wind production tax credit, and so on, as a convenient point of political argument and kind of a pawn on a larger political chessboard. But I think on both sides of the spectrum, people are really pretty fed up with gridlock and want to get stuff done, which is, of course, why we work mainly with the private sector. And it's therefore very good news that in Reinventing Fire, we don't care whether you care most about jobs and profits and competitive advantage, or about national security, or about health and environmental stewardship, because whatever most motivates you, let's focus on the outcomes, not the motives, and we ought to do the same things anyway for whatever reason. And then the stuff we don't agree about tends to become superfluous.
You said we need to level the playing field in terms of foreign competitors. What do you mean by that? Does that mean tariffs on dumping of solar panels, for example?
Well, I think it's too early to tell what the evidence is on that, and it's gone into a trade dispute process, and it'll be resolved there. many governments, including China's, including our own, support different forms of energy in different ways, and that's a pretty complex slippery slope to get onto.
Then what do you mean leveling the playing field?
Oh, well, I was referring, for example, to allowing ways to save or produce energy to compete fairly and without undue obstacles. One of the interesting things in the case of Texas you mentioned actually came from Governor George W. Bush. His PUC chair, Pat Woods, put in a very nice rule that's kind of plug and play that says if the inverter or attaching your solar system to the grid is on the approved list, that it meets all the technical and safety requirements, you can connect it and just start generating and sending power back to the grid without asking or even telling your utility, because you won't hurt the linemen, you won't burn down your house, nothing more should be asked of you. And that is the kind of competition-promoting rule that I think we need a lot more of.
Talking with Amory Lovins, author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Let's go out to Tom in the Bay Area in California. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm not a flat earth guy, so I get this whole idea about renewable energy and electric cars and stuff like that. But the problem is that, in my opinion, all this stuff is still a science experiment. We're no more efficient today than what we were 50, 60 years ago for wind power and solar. I personally think nuclear is the only option for a sustainable different shade of green power source. And the thing is, what are all these electric cars? We put 50 million electric cars on the road. What are all these electric cars going to plug into? They're going to plug into an anemic, weak grid that can barely hang on the way it is right now. We need to spend trillions of dollars a year into our infrastructure just to get where it can absorb all of the renewable energy, our efficiency stuff that we're trying to do with electric cars and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, the one thing that you're not going to see is an electric bulldozer or an electric tractor trailer. That will never happen. So it's always going to be a land where diesel is going to be out there. And, that's just my personal opinion.
Let me get it. Amory, how do you react to that?
Well, if you'd be kind enough to look at Reinventing Fire, and the technical backup for that will go up on the 27th at reinventingfire.com, you'll find we've documented very carefully from the actual market prices the very dramatic, many-fold drops in solar and wind price and increases in effectiveness in recent years. And that is why the solar business is growing 65% a year for the last decade. It is why wind power contracts are now being written as low as 3 cents a kilowatt hour, beating the wholesale price. We did examine the nuclear option and found, as investors have found, that it simply has no business case. That's why neither new nuclear nor new coal plants are in the official U.S. forecasts for what's going to be built. They simply don't pay anymore. Better technologies have come along that do the job cheaper, more reliably, more resiliently. And when we looked in particular at a distributed renewable future, we found it could resolve all of the technical, financial, security, climate, and other risks of the existing grid a lot better, and not only be equally or more reliable, but be much more resilient, so that we wouldn't risk in the grid we now have, which I agree is very secure. We wouldn't risk cascading and potentially nation-shattering blackouts from solar storms or terrorism or a natural disaster. Rather, we would make major failures impossible by design. So I think if you look at the evidence in Reinventing Fire, you'll find that the technology and deployment have moved on beyond what you think is out there. But you are absolutely right that we're unlikely to have electric trucks. Heavy trucks can be tripled efficiency. They will end up running on any mixture of advanced biofuels and hydrogen, or if you like, you can run them on natural gas, but they won't need oil.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Amory Levins. Amory, I have about a minute left. Where do we start first here?
Well, I would suggest starting by really informing yourself about the very exciting business opportunities, new technologies, new designs, new policies, new business strategies that are coming at us thick and fast in oil, electricity, in buildings and industry, in every sector. Because the energy use we have is the sum of millions of decisions we made. Now we have better ways to make smarter decisions to capture our piece, each of us, of that $5 trillion that's sitting on the table.
You're saying renewable energy is really good big business now.
Absolutely. It's a $200 billion a year global business. We need to get our piece of it as we build for ourselves the core industries of the 21st century, and efficiently use that new fire can make energy do our work without working our undoing.
Thank you very much for joining us, Amory. Amory Levins is author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
That music means it's time for our monthly episode of Science Diction, where we talk about the origin of scientific words with Howard Markel, professor of history of medicine, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome, Howard.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
What word do we have today?
Well, it's a great one. It's the Bunsen burner.
Oh, the Bunsen burner.
And we all know what it is. It's the iconic symbol of high school chemistry. But how many people know who Bunsen was?
You're right.
And he was a brilliant chemist. Robert Bunsen was his name. And he was a graduate of the University of Göttingen, where his father was the chief librarian. But he actually created, with some laboratory assistants, the Bunsen burner, or the gas burner, in 1855. Now, chemists have been arguing for years over who deserves the credit. Bunsen and a colleague named Henry Roscoe actually wrote it up in 1857. But, you know, there were prototypical gas burners even before that from the 1820s on. But those earlier forms used to produce diffuse and flickering light, and they were very flammable, no pun intended, that if you didn't put a metal wire over a mesh, the flames would get all over the place. But that introduced artifactual colors and soot and all other things like that.
Mm-hmm. And was it really basically the same one we have today? No,
pretty much. I mean, there's been a few, you know, tweaks here and there. But, you know, it's kind of neat. You know, all great laboratory equipment is the result of doing experiments. And Bunsen and his colleagues were trying to look at the spectral analysis of elements and compounds. They had a theory that each compound or element had a fingerprint if you burned it, and you could measure that through a prism. So that was really novel, but they didn't have a good source of heat to do that. These earlier flames would just be, you know, not sufficient.
Yeah.
And they figured this out one day when they, I'm sure you remember doing this in eighth grade, they burned a piece of magnesium.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that?
Pretty hot.
I can still see that bright light, that bright white light. And then they said, well, maybe other compounds have this as well. So they needed the right type of heat source. And, you know, the great unsung heroes of science, I think, are the apparatus makers. You know, before there were, you know, Erlenmeyer flasks, someone had to blow those and make them. And
right.
The same thing with the Bunsen burner. It was a very neat guy named Peter de Saga. And this, he toyed with the length of the tube and the width of the tube, so that created a colorless, sootless flame. It was very hot. It didn't flicker, and it didn't need that wire mesh, so it didn't introduce any artifactual colors.
And there you have it. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks a lot, Ira.
Always a pleasure. Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flatow is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flatow. Thanks for listening.